Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampake Pagan, and this is Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia.
Lights! Give me a light.
Thank you.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Orson Welles. I'm speaking for the Mercury Theater, and what follows is supposed to advertise our first motion picture. Citizen Kane is the title, and we hope it can correctly be called a coming attraction. It's certainly coming to this theater, and I think our Mercury actors make it an attraction. I'd like you to meet them. Speaking of attractions, well, the chorus girls are certainly an attraction. But frankly,
so, Harlan, we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of Citizen Kane, and while I can probably write you a 3,000-word essay on why it's one of the greatest, and you can write an entire book on why it's one of the greatest, I still find it difficult to boil that down to people. And so, Harlan, I'm going to ask you, why this movie, why is this the greatest American film of all time?
If you're looking, you're right, we could spend 5 minutes, 2 days, or an entire year of school talking about it.
Absolutely.
Great. I'm sorry. Hello, my name is Harlan Lebo.
And what do you do?
Oh, I'm a senior fellow at the USC Annenberg Center for the Digital Future in Los Angeles, and I've been a writer for the last 30 years, and I've been very fortunate to write books about Citizen Kane, Casablanca, and The Godfather, and most recently a new book on Citizen Kane, which is celebrating the 75th anniversary, and it'll be available after April 26th. The easiest way to describe it is that the film vividly and successfully solves every kind of creative problem that a movie could have, whether that's creating a wonderful script, wonderful characters, just capturing the essence of all of these people, and then using all of the tools that are available in the Hollywood studio system to achieve those goals. Meaning using photography and deep sets and beautiful designs and creating all kinds of transitions between scenes and special effects, because the movie is filled with special effects, if you can believe that.
My favorite movie of all time is Citizen Kane. Some of these special effects shots that they orchestrated were just phenomenal. And a lot of that, I think, came about because Orson Welles was just a novice. That was his first film. How old was he? In his 20s, 25? 25 years old. And he didn't know what he couldn't do. He just, you know, and Greg Toland gave him all the confidence in the world. This old master said, you know, well, you've done theater, you know lighting. And
it's just so successfully solves all those problems. That's what makes it a true success.
So I was going to split this story up into three parts. I was going to talk about Orson Welles, I was going to talk about William Randolph Hearst, and I was going to talk about the film. But let's start with Orson Welles, because I have this image, and it's based entirely on that now famous quote, which he once told an interviewer about how everyone told me from the moment I could hear that I was absolutely marvelous. Mm-hmm. And I have this image of this young, cocky wonder boy with little respect for anyone or anything else. Is that accurate?
Well, I think the Wonder Boy part is, and the creative genius part is, he was a very strong creative personality. He certainly liked and respected many people and worshiped people. I mean, John Ford was one of his idols. So he was a tremendously gifted creative person, whether it was painting or writing or radio or theater, and then that moved all onto film. And of course, by happy coincidence, he was also tall and very handsome and had a beautiful voice. So all of those things added in. But cocky, absolutely. Incredibly self-confident, absolutely. But quite respectful of most people, as long as they didn't get in his way.
What did he think of the studio system at the time?
I think as a system, he probably didn't like it any better than anyone else who was a very powerful creative talent like John Ford or Howard Hawks. There, it was a real love-hate relationship. People like them realized that it was a frustrating, maddening experience because the effort to make films that appeal to the broadest audience was what the studios wanted to do. And that was all handicapped, of course, by censorship in Hollywood, which kept a very tight rein on what anyone could be making films about. But on the other side of that is the fact that the studios created these gigantic pools of incredible talent, wonderful technicians and craftsmen and writers and designers and photographers who were the best in the world and probably still are the best in the world, some would say. And that's what Welles really appreciated. And he always thought that. I mean, he respected technicians. He respected the creative people around him. He felt very strong connections with actors. So all of that is a happy byproduct of a system that did not function very well for people like Orson Welles. But for at least one film, and for some others too along the line, but certainly for Citizen Kane, you have this incredibly talented, imaginative, young personality diving headfirst into this pool of creative talent and collaborating with them, and that's what created Citizen Kane.
And I wonder if it really was. I think it always was show business, and that when there were big studios, which still existed when I went to Hollywood, but were in their very last days as golden age big studios, I think they were pretending to be factories, and it was still show business. It's true they were grinding them out and all that, but it's show business. The true industrial process cannot be as helter-skelter and idiotic as every form of show business is. Otherwise, every car we'd get in would break down after the second block. I can't believe the rest of the people are as stupid as we are.
So tell me about Orson Welles coming into the studio system, coming in to make, I guess, what was called RKO 281. It's interesting because he's had no real experience of that at all. I mean, he's coming off, I guess, tremendous success with War of the Worlds, something that could have completely ruined him but didn't. And suddenly he's thrown into this new world where he knows little to nothing about.
Right. He was quite experienced in radio in a very short time. I mean, remember, he was, at the time of War of the Worlds, he was 23 years old, which is the fall of 1938. He had been involved in radio production for only a couple of years, theater for not much longer, at least on the Broadway level. But he had probably made by that point hundreds of radio programs, either as an actor, a character actor performing, or as a writer, or as a producer himself, including his own radio program, Mercury Theater of the Air.
Network executives had ordered the broadcast be interrupted with an identifying station break at once. The CBS switchboards were overwhelmed. Listeners had to be told it was only a play. Welles was then at the mic. The room was his. And at that point in the show, there was no stopping him.
So he was quite involved at that level, immensely talented as a creative writer, director, editor, and actor in both theater and in radio. So it was a natural step to move to Hollywood and to make motion pictures, but a completely different kind of a step in terms of techniques, in terms of putting things and ideas and people in front of cameras. And all of that had to be learned, and learned very quickly. And he certainly learned very quickly.
But where did the trust come from? I mean, everything I read about studios is that they're a naturally suspicious, controlling lot.
And even more controlling then. there was no, the trust was contractual. Orson Welles had no, he says he had no real interest in coming to Hollywood at that point. I really was the next place for him to go. He had things that sort of tapered off for him in, on Broadway. And he wanted very much to use any money he earned in Hollywood to go back and create theater. As it turned out, he stayed in movies for most of the rest of his life. But he held out as long as he could. He did not want to do this. At least that's how he remembered it. And what he really wanted was not as much the money as he wanted authority. And RKO kept sweetening the deal more and more. And they finally gave him a deal that really was, in the words of another movie, an offer he just couldn't refuse, which is that he had near total creative control, not complete creative control the way has been portrayed over the years, but certainly much more than anyone else in Hollywood at the time. There was no other producer, director, or actor in Hollywood working within mainstream Hollywood at the time who had anything like the creative control he had. And that really boiled down to he had right of final cut to the movie. As long as he met certain limits about budget, then he would be able to hold on to the final cut of the film. And that was really unheard of. So it wasn't trust, it was contract. And that's where it all came from. And RKO, they wanted him to succeed. They wanted him to make money. He was part of the new regime at RKO that was led by George Schaefer, bringing in talented people, many of whom had, did not have experience in Hollywood. And Welles was one of them.
I must admit that it was intended consciously as a sort of social document, as an attack on the acquisitive society, and indeed on acquisition in general. But I didn't think that up and then try to find a story to match the idea. Of course, I think the storyteller's first duty is always to the story.
So let's talk about William Randolph Hearst. I think a lot of people know the kind of media mogul he was, but just paint me a picture as to just how much power and influence he wielded.
There were certainly other powerful newspaper owners and media. Well, it was the press then, it wasn't media, but certainly the media of its time. He was probably the singular figure who was most prominent. He was the Rupert Murdoch of his age, probably more influential and more powerful because his organization was even more ruthless and irresponsible in many of its journalistic practices than anyone today that we could imagine.
Is that really your idea of how to run a newspaper?
I don't know how to run a newspaper, Mr. Thatcher. I just try everything I can think of.
Todd, you know perfectly well there's not the slightest proof that this armada's off the Jersey
Hello,
coast.
Mr. Bernstein.
Excuse me, Mr.
Can
Kane.
You prove it isn't?
This just
Mr. Bernstein,
in.
I'd like you to meet Mr. Thatcher.
I'll just borrow
How do you do,
it,
Mr. Thatcher?
Leland,
Hello.
Mr. Thatcher, my ex-guardian. We have no secrets from our readers, Mr. Bernstein. Mr. Thatcher is one of our most devoted readers. He knows what's wrong with every copy of the Inquirer since I took over. Read the cable.
Girls delightful in Cuba, stop.
Could send you prose poems about scenery, but don't feel right spending your money. Stop. There is no war in Cuba. Signed, Wheeler. Any answer?
Yes, dear Wheeler, you provide the prose poems. I'll provide the war.
That's fine, Mr. Kane.
Yes, I rather liked myself.
Charles,
I it right away.
I came to see you about
the Hearst organization really created sensationalist tabloid journalism in its own way. Even in its mainstream papers, they would pick and choose their battles. They would choose causes to support or fight. And as a result, Hearst was incredibly influential, very powerful. And as an individual personality, very high profile in 1920s, 30s, and 40s America. He was very prominent in Hollywood circles. He had his own production company. His mistress, Marion Davies, was a prominent comedic actress. And he was known for hobnobbing with celebrities and having them as guests at his home in Beverly Hills, as well as his mountaintop estate in Central California called San Simeon.
Mm-hmm.
This is Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia. I'm Uma Paganampake Pagan, and that was Harlan Lebo, who is joining me today to tell the remarkable story behind the making of the greatest American movie of all time, Citizen Kane. So whose idea was Citizen Kane? Was it Orson Welles or was it Herman Mankiewicz?
It came out from both of them. It came from their discussions. Herman Mankiewicz and John Houseman went out into the desert of California to a place called Victorville to write the script for Citizen Kane, or at least the first draft. But before they went, there were dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of hours of discussions between Mankiewicz and Welles about people, characters, the types of subjects they could do, powerful people. And they came around to the idea that they really wanted to explore a powerful person. And they started nosing around to think, who could they write about that was a powerful person that would be interesting? Well, politicians, of course, are difficult because you have to identify them by name. There are other powerful people in industry. They even considered doing Howard Hughes as a possible character. But it just didn't seem that interesting to write about oil and oil wells and his work in aviation, at least at that point. And had they done a movie about Howard Hughes, it would not have been played by Orson Welles. It would have been played by Joseph Cotten, who in Citizen Kane went on to be, he appeared in Citizen Kane as Kane's best friend, Jed Leland.
Hey, give Joe a little light. Thanks. Now smile for the folks, Joe. Smile. Joseph Cotten, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Joseph Cotten, I think you're going to see a lot of him.
So they eventually circled around. Because of the tone of the day, they circled around to newspapers and newspaper publishers. And there was no question that William Randolph Hearst came up early in the discussions. He certainly was the most powerful newspaper publisher of his day. Mankiewicz knew him well because he had visited his home many times, both in Beverly Hills, for William Randolph Hearst's famous costume parties. They had lots of costume parties. And Mankiewicz had also been a guest at San Simeon, the mountaintop estate. So it would have been hard for someone as self-destructive and antisocial as Herman Mankiewicz was capable of being, a very charming person on one hand, but also capable of being a very angry, very vengeful person on the other, to circle in on William Randolph Hearst as one of the principal people who Charles Foster Kane was based on. And that certainly is true. There are many people who are represented in the character of Charles Foster Kane, but it's, you know, there's no question that William Randolph Hearst is one of the principal ones.
So there's this movie, right, by HBO starring Liev Schreiber, Archeo 281. And I remember watching that film, and I think one of the takeaways of that film was that somehow Orson Welles and William Randolph Hearst were different sides of the same coin. And there was something about Hearst that rubbed Welles the wrong way. Was that depiction accurate? It seemed almost personal.
Well, not personal as much as it was. And the movie, I'm not a huge fan of the movie. I don't think it represented any of the characters at all very well. I thought Liev Schreiber did a wonderful job playing Orson Welles. But it's nothing like the real story. And people just love stretching the real story. There's even a documentary about the making of the film where people, the producers are convinced somehow that Hearst and Welles were destined by fate to clash someday. And that, of course, is absurd. They weren't. But Welles did have a fascination early in his life about wealth and about acquisition of wealth and about power. And that carried on through his entire life. He was fascinated by powerful men as characters. In fact, if you look at almost all of his films that he produced and wrote and directed, as opposed to the ones he acted in for other people, but those that he created himself, they're almost all about what he called the damned man. Men who are very powerful and very influential in their own circles, but also failures.
And even in his theater, Macbeth, Julius Caesar, the kind of plays he's noted for are precisely about that.
That's right. He was fascinated by that for his entire career, radio programs as well, but primarily in movies. Those were when he really focused in, zeroed in on the damned man. And that really starts with, I'm sure, in part a fascination with Hearst, because I'm sure Welles viewed Hearst the way many people, the way many liberal people in the United States did, which is here's a powerful man who started off trying to be the friend of the working man and a liberal, a crusader for the public. And what he really turned out to be was a narrow-minded right-wing elitist who was the poster child for yellow journalism, what we call yellow journalism in the United States, or tabloid press. And I'm sure that was a fascinating thing for Wells, because I'm sure he believed that Hearst was a failure, which he was. But to think that he had a personal grudge against Hearst, no, he certainly didn't. There are just as many other powerful people who are represented in the movie as in addition to William Randolph Hearst. But it's certainly true that looking at the way people fail in life was an important part of what Wells did in his films. And I have to say that if you really look at it carefully, Charles Foster Kane could easily be confused with Orson Welles. There are many things about Orson Welles himself that are quite similar to Charles Foster Kane.
Emily, I hear you've been stepping out with Charlie Kane.
Of course I love him. I gave him $60 million.
Well, of course I love him. He's the richest man in America.
But all the girls say about him at first.
But you know, I can't help but admire him.
He's crazy.
He's wonderful.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what you'll think about Mr. Kane. I can't imagine. You see, I play the part myself. Well, Kane is a hero and a scoundrel, a no-account and a swell guy, a great lover, a great American citizen, and a dirty dog. It depends on who's talking about him. What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.
Is it true that when Citizen Kane was being made, that people actually tried to stop it being made? And is it true that Randolph Hearst, the newspaper tycoon, took it as being an attack on himself and tried to stop it when it was made being shown?
To the first part of your question, there was indeed a very definite effort to stop the film during shooting by those elements in the studio who were attempting to seize power, because in those days, studio politics, particularly RKO and indeed many of the big studios in Hollywood, were very much like Central American republics. And there were revolutions and counter-revolutions and every sort of palace intrigue. And there was a big effort to overthrow the then head of the studio, who was taken to be out of his mind because he'd given me this contract, which made the making of these films possible. And stopping me or proving my incompetence would have won their case. Mr. Hearst was quite a bit like Kane, although Kane isn't really founded on Hearst in particular. There are many people sat for it, so to speak. But he was like Kane in that he wouldn't have stooped to such a thing. But he had many hatchet men, editors and representatives of this great network of newspapers all over the country. And to get in good with the chief, there was a good deal of very strong hatchet, including an effort to frame me on a criminal charge, which a policeman was good enough to tell me about. It's sensational and silly and dangerous and gangsterish as that.
So let's talk about the battle over Citizen Kane, because as the story goes, William Randolph Hearst kind of discovers that this movie is somewhat loosely based on him, and for lack of a better phrase, he loses it and uses, I guess, everything available within his power to try and stop this movie from happening.
Yes, he had an organization that was geared to protect. They called him the Chief. If you called Mr. Hearst the chief, you were in his inner circle. So the chief needed to be protected, and his organization was ruthless enough and morally bankrupt enough in many ways that they would take off after someone like Orson Welles and RKO and the motion picture industry in general to try to protect the chief. The fact that by focusing their attention on Citizen Kane, on Charles Foster Kane as a character, as being a caricature right or wrong of William Randolph Hearst just made it all that much more public. The story was covered at length in the national media, and had Hearst and his people not done this, had they not tried to stop the film, had they not tried to have it destroyed, if they hadn't tried to blackmail Hollywood by threatening to write expose stories about powerful people in Hollywood, none of this would have happened. And the film would have gone down and been what it should have been, which was a very successful film at the time and a wonderful character study. And William Randolph Hearst would have been one of the people that might have been considered as a possible character.
Well, do you think that the figure of Cain himself is a deeply unsympathetic figure? In Soviet Union, for example, the film has been forbidden general distribution because this important capitalist and newspaper tycoon and anti-social and crypto-fascist figure, etc., to quote all the slogans, is too sympathetic. And for that reason, it's not shown, never has been.
So they red-baited, what we call red-baiting in the United States, where you do an investigation of someone's communist sympathies. And of course, Wells is a very liberal person. He was not a communist. But the Hearst organization launched an investigation of him. They cooperated with the congressional committees that were quite active in the 1940s and 50s looking at communism in Hollywood. They provided information to that committee. They investigated Wells' draft status during World War II. They tried to discredit him and his involvement in liberal causes. And then they encouraged conservative organizations like the American Legion to attack Wells and be critical of Wells and his radio broadcasts. And then Hearst's publications covered the protests. So they created the protests and then covered the protests. It's like Charles Foster Kane said, if you make the headline big enough, it makes the story big enough. Well, that's exactly what Hearst did. So it was an organization that described itself as standing for genuine democracy and used words like character and quality and an American paper for the American people on its masthead. Yet it really was a truly dark chapter in American journalism.
And did Wells not expect any of this? Did he not realize the extent of William Randolph Hearst's power? Or was he just arrogant, too arrogant to notice?
I think he was probably expecting some level of fuss over the film, but I think he was also not really worried about it. He was just trying to get the movie made and didn't think that it would be anything like this, where they would go after him that strongly. Because there are certainly other people who could have been just as upset. You know, there are executives who are Joseph Pulitzer, or the people who work for Pulitzer's papers after, you know, Pulitzer passed away. There are people in industry, in music, in other places in publishing who could have just been just as upset. So we all think of it in terms of a story about Hearst. And visually, of course, it is a story about Hearst. When you think about the big house on the hill in Xanadu and some of the things that are quoted directly from Hearst or his family that were used in the film. But I don't think, answering your question, I don't think he expected nearly this level of protest.
And what was RKO's reaction? I'm sure the studio must have been freaking out.
Well, the studio was trying to figure out what to do about the movie. Remember, when all of the actions against Citizen Kane as a film started, RKO was hit just as hard. On January 9th, when Luella Parsons finally did see the film and reported back that, yes, indeed, Citizen Kane was about William Randolph Hearst, that day, every Hearst organization in the country was ordered to remove all mention of Citizen Kane and Orson Welles and RKO and every RKO film from their publications. That happened the same day. So RKO was attacked directly and immediately. And that wasn't lifted for almost 2 weeks. So there were 2 weeks worth of reviews and features that never appeared in Hearst papers that would have been very important to RKO. So the studio was threatened. Hollywood itself was threatened. Luella Parsons made it very clear, Luella Parsons being the lead film columnist for the Hearst organization, that if something wasn't done about Orson Welles and Citizen Kane, that Hearst publications would suddenly start carrying incriminating expose stories about motion picture stars and executives in Hollywood, stories that were may have been true but were conveniently not covered as favors to the Hollywood studios. So yes, RKO was quite puzzled by what to do about this, and it went back and forth for weeks with them trying to decide what to do, whether they were going to release the film, whether they were going to shelve the film, or whether they were going to accept the offer that was made within one part of the Hollywood circle to buy the film and destroy it.
Orson, he knows. Do you understand what that means, that he knows? He knows.
What are you so afraid of, Mike? It's done. It's in the can. There's nothing they can do.
Yeah, and it will stay in the can. That film will never come out. Hearst will not allow it. The studio heads will not allow it. That film will never see the light of day.
Are you on their side, Mank? That's what it sounds like to me. Are you on their side? I mean, for Christ's sakes, you wrote the goddamn script. You fought for the credit.
That's right. And I told you that this would happen. Didn't I tell you? Huh? Right. Listen, I got my check. You got yours. Let's move on.
I will not move on! Who are they, Mank? Who are these men that you're so afraid of? Who are these tiny little f***ing men? They're accountants.
We're ready. You want to hear it?
I remember reading somewhere that Orson Welles and Citizen Kane were actually booed at the Academy Awards. Is that true?
Well, in part. I mean, there were certainly, that's always been the way it's been built up, that yes, there was booing when Citizen Kane's name was mentioned, but there were just as many people who were apparently, and I've talked to people who were there, just as many people who were shushing the booers, who were quite supportive. Welles had a huge base of support in Hollywood once the film started to be shown. Most directors were supportive of him, most influential actors. The problem, I think, really occurred, and the booing probably occurred, because it had been made clear when he arrived in Hollywood, there was a big deal made out of the fact that he wasn't going to use any Hollywood talent on screen, any at all. And of course, he did use some, but almost all of the principal roles in Citizen Kane are people who came from the Mercury Theater or from New York and were not Hollywood regulars.
We're talking today about Citizen Kane. The movie turned 75 this year, and I'm speaking to Harlan Lebo. He's got a new book out that chronicles the making of what is widely considered to be the greatest American movie of all time. This, of course, is Hari Nidalamsajaradunia with me, Uma Paganamke Bhagat.
It means everything to me. Citizen Kane is if not the icon, it is an icon of courage. I'm talking about the courage of the filmmaker, the courage, the audacity. It's about courage and audacity, and I'm making this my way, and I'm going to deepen the focus. I don't care how many layers of makeup those actors sweat off. We're going to see from 1 inch to infinity in every shot. We're going to see ceilings, and we're going to tell a very convoluted mystery story about a man's life, and it is just one of the great movies ever made, and I think many people are going to agree it's just one of the great American experiences in the cinema.
So you've got this brand new book coming out. It's been 75 years. How do you find new information, more so when most everyone who was involved in this movie is dead or really, really, really old?
Well, I did a coffee table book about Citizen Kane for the 50th anniversary 25 years ago. Can't believe it, but it's 25 years. And I was fortunate enough to talk to four of the key people who were involved in the making of the film that time, who were still alive. William Allen, who played the reporter who was searching for the secret of Rosebud. Ruth Warwick, who played Kane's first wife, Emily Monroe Norton. Richard Wilson, who was one of Welles' longtime confidants and one of his associate producers, and Robert Wise, the Academy Award winning director, who was a staff editor at RKO at the time and edited Citizen Kane, was nominated for an Academy Award for Citizen Kane. And then more recently, I talked with the family of Catherine Trosper, who was Wells' assistant at the time and actually just passed away in March. She just missed her 101st birthday and learned many more things from her. So I was fortunate enough to be able to talk to that, at least those five people. But also remember that as much as has been written about Citizen Kane, between criticism and compendiums of reviews and interviews about it and all sorts of things, no one other than my coffee table book about Citizen Kane has ever been a nonfiction narrative about the making of the movie. This is the first time there's ever been a making of book for the public about Citizen Kane. So there's plenty of information out there about from Orson Welles' own files and from Hearst's own files. But because I was the first one writing a book like this, it was all prime territory. And there are some wonderful people out there in the United States who can help with this sort of thing.
The one thing that really surprised me, I was looking at the old New York Times review from 1941, yes. And they're incredibly effusive about this movie. And it's interesting because I think it's rare that a great movie is recognized in its time at the point of release.
In this case, it was not only recognized as a great film, I think it was recognized as a milestone in cinema. The reviews were almost unanimously, overwhelmingly positive. Huge acclaim for the movie, for the acting, for the cinematography. People knew this was a special film. And they, whatever criticism there was of the contract Orson Welles had when he came to Hollywood was all thrown out when they saw Citizen Kane.
Now, when you made this film, you were only 25, weren't you? I mean, everybody knows that you had the most astonishing contract that Hollywood has ever provided.
Yes.
Ever.
Not financially speaking, in terms of authority and rights. Financially, it wasn't extraordinary in any way at all. It was extraordinary in the control it gave me over my own material.
You had total control.
Total control, so much so that the rushes, which I perhaps should explain are the pieces of film that are shown at the end of the day's work, as I'm sure you understand, and are always checked by everybody in the studio, department heads and the bankers and distributors and everything, long before there's a rough cut. But according to the terms of my contract, the rushes couldn't be seen by anyone. Mm. And indeed, the film couldn't be seen until it was ready for release. I got that good a contract because I didn't really want to make a film.
Well, you better develop that.
And you know, when you don't really want to go out to Hollywood, or at least this was true in the old days, or the golden days of Hollywood, when you honestly didn't want to go, then the deals got better and better. In my case, I didn't want money. I wanted authority. So I asked the impossible, hoping to be left alone. And at the end of a year's negotiations, I got it.
The one possible bit of criticism of the film actually was voiced in the New York Times 3 days later when Bosley Crowther, the critic for the Times, went and did a reappraisal of Citizen Kane. He went back and watched the movie a second time and wrote about it again, because the one thing about the movie that puzzled him was the character of Charles Foster Kane as being hard to understand and explain.
The odd thing about the picture, and I've seen it countless times, you know, the enigma of it is Kane itself, Kane himself. You don't know him. You can't get to know him. He's afraid of knowing himself. He's afraid of letting anything out that might be indicative of his feelings, his emotions. And it's not, he's not passive, though. He's not passive, but he's got this wall up that, how many times I've seen the picture, I cannot get, I can't really feel for him as much as I did in the beginning. But in the beginning, when I first saw the film many times, I was feeling more for Orson Welles himself acting in the film. I liked him personally.
But that's actually one of the great strengths of the film. And I think we understand male leading characters in films better now. But people just didn't understand why you could put Charles Foster Kane into a film and not really explain his motivations. Because no one in the film understands why Charles Foster Kane does what he does. No one who sees the movie understands why he does. But what you do see is the consequences of his actions. How through his search for love and friendship led to his complete disasters for him on every level in his life. So that was the puzzle that Bosley Crowther was trying to work out, and some other reviewers were too. But other than that, it was considered a masterpiece, a literal masterpiece of the time.
Rosebud, the most famous single word in the history of the cinema, and it was the last word uttered by the dying Charles Foster Kane, a millionaire press lord who built a media empire in a vast castle in Florida, who collected warehouses full of art, but was never able to regain the one thing he had lost in childhood, the love of his parents.
Harlan, I've got one more question for you, and this is just a little bit of trivia.
Sure.
Because in that movie, RKO 281 by HBO, they have a theory as to what Rosebud means in the William Randolph mm-hmm. Hearst context. Was
yes.
that true?
Well, there are several different interpretations of what Rosebud can mean. One of them was that it was Hearst's nickname for Marion Davies' private parts. That has certainly been voiced by several people who Herman Mankiewicz had talked to. Of course, if Herman Mankiewicz wrote the original script for Rosebud, being a inside friend of the Hearst family, and he used that term, it would have been that would have been his professional suicide to do that, and it would have been made very clear to everyone involved that they were indeed writing about Hearst. But more recently, Mankiewicz testified. He died in 1953. In a lawsuit in the late 40s, he testified that Rosebud represented his interest in, of all things, horse racing, which there was a horse in the United States that won the Kentucky Derby called Old Rosebud, and Mankiewicz bet on it early in his life, and he remembered that, and that's supposedly one of the reasons why the sled was named Rosebud. The other story that he told his son that Frank Mankiewicz relayed years later was that Rosebud was the name of Mankiewicz's bicycle when he was a kid. So they're all interesting. The point being, they're in some level, they all represent points out of Mankiewicz's past or out of Hearst's present, in case of the one that you were talking about and mentioning. Yes.
I have heard it suggested that Citizen Kane is in some sort of sense autobiographical.
The notion that Kane himself is some sort of version of myself, I'd really fail to recognize. Maybe out of blindness, but it seems to me that Kane is everything that I'm not, good and bad.
You can find Harlan Lebo's brand new book, Citizen Kane, A Filmmaker's Journey, at all good bookstores. You've been listening to Hari Nidalam Sajaradunia, The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it. All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.